Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota in Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit toyotaonnicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at lexusoflexington.com. Introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.
Welcome to Triumphs and Tragedies. I'm Father Dwight Longenecker. This is episode 22 of our podcast series on the history of the Catholic Church. We now approach the 20th century, such a momentous age in which so much takes place and there's so much drama. And we will be dealing with the 20th century and then into the 21st century in the next episode. The next episode will take us from the Second Vatican Council onwards. First, though, there's an awful lot to deal with in the 20th century, and as usual, I want to backtrack a little bit to put this into context. You remember in the 19th century, the great Pope Pius IX, who had one of the longest papacies ever, was dealing with the struggle with liberalism. Liberalism had come out of the French Revolution and out of the Enlightenment, and was basically trying to bring the Church up to date. And we'll find that really, from the Reformation onward, in these last 500 years of Church history, this is the constant struggle. How much does the Church remain the same and hold to its timeless truths? How much can it adapt and fit in with a world that is changing faster and faster? And over these last 500 years, we find that the rate of change snowballs, so that by the time we get to the 20th century and into our own age, the rate of change is an extraordinarily rapid rate, which the world had never seen before. And therefore, how does a church this 2,000 years old, an institution this 2,000 years old, try to adapt to this fast-changing world? And this is the conflict that we see really from the 16th century onward. But now as we get into the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries, the snowball rolls ever faster. It's like a runaway train. And the church really is struggling to know how to deal with the challenges of the modern world. This puts the struggle that Pius IX had with liberalism into context. To give the liberals the benefit of the doubt, they're trying to help the church to relate to the modern world. They think the church, instead of retreating into its fortress mentality and its fundamentalism and rejecting everything modern, should try to find what is good in the modern world and adapt it and take it and sort of baptize it and embrace it. You might remember in the last episode, it was the French theologian Lamennais who went to try to bring the church into the modern age and approach the Pope. It was Pope Gregory the 16th. I made a mistake and said it was Gregory the 12th. It was Pope Gregory the 16th. And Gregory the 16th came down like a hammer against Lamennais' attempt to introduce liberalism into the church. And he was, of course, succeeded by Pius IX. And Pius IX, Pio Nono, dominates the 19th century. And although Pio Nono is a much beloved pope, and he's a gentle pope, and he's wise, he also is completely conservative and smashes liberalism and really suppresses it so that it can't make any headway at all. Remember, liberalism is standing for the rights of the common man, for freedom of speech, freedom of religion. It's standing for democracy. It was the the fruit of the French Revolution. And this is one of the reasons the church was so opposed to it, because the church said, no, this has obviously been seen to end up in bloodshed. And so in the 19th century, the church has this great conservative revival under the leadership of Pius IX. He's succeeded at the end of the century by Leo XIII. And Leo XIII, with his social teaching, introduces the social teaching, which allows the church to begin to accept some of the social doctrines of liberalism without necessarily accepting its philosophy and accepting the theology of liberalism. It's also during the 19th century that under Gregory the 16th that the great missionary efforts begin as colonialism, European colonialism, moves into the Far East and into Africa. They take the Christian faith with them. And so we're going to talk a little bit further about the expansion of the Catholic Church overseas in the 19th and then into the 20th century. This is a time of great expansion when, as there was great missionary efforts in the 16th and 17th century in the Counter-Reformation, we also see another great wave of missionary enterprise as the church reaches down into Africa, India, and into the Far East. As I say, we'll come back and talk about that in more detail later, but this struggle with liberalism doesn't go away. Although Pius IX suppresses liberalism and crushes the liberal tendency towards liberalism, of course, this can't last very long, because whenever you try to suppress intellectual inquiry and try to suppress questions, they keep coming back. And so from the Reformation and then from the Enlightenment and then in the struggle with liberalism, we now move into the 20th century, where the same monster, if you like, the same beast represents itself. And this time the term for it is modernism. And modernism is, again, the same struggle between how much we adapt the church to the modern age and how much the church cannot change at all. And so the struggle with modernism rears its head in the early 20th century. And these are the pressures that the church is facing. The society is going through an increasingly rapid change, and that change has to do with the development of science and new technologies. Also, along with this goes a kind of economic utilitarianism, which means that basically whatever works is good, and that philosophy is being promoted politically and economically. At the same time, with the growth of science and Darwinism and rationalism, comes an upsurge, especially, first of all, in Protestantism, but then also in Catholicism, of biblical criticism. Basically, from the Enlightenment onward, the scholars are looking at the Bible, which had been treated in a very superstitious and in a very fundamentalist and primitive way, and they're beginning to say, look, well, you know, we've looked at the history here, we've looked at the background, we looked at the science. Did these miracles really happen? Did the Garden of Eden really happen like this? Did Noah's flood really take place? What about the story of Jonah being swallowed by a whale? And so forth. All through the Bible, the biblical scholars are beginning to test the stories that are there and examine the stories that are there to see whether they're historical. Discoveries are being made in the ancient languages, and new texts are being discovered of the ancient scriptures. The rationalistic Protestant mindset is being exerted not only on the biblical texts, but also on the doctrines of the church. And the modernists are therefore attacking undermining the church. But remember, they're doing so with a good intention. They don't mean to be destructive for destruction's own sake. They're trying to bring the light of reason and trying to bring the light of their understanding to the ancient faith, both scriptural aspects and the doctrinal and the moral aspects of the faith, because they want it to be able to survive into the modern age. They believe that if you can take away the miraculous and the superstitious from the Christian faith, that what will emerge is a faith for the modern age, a faith which people can hold to with strong moral teachings and with this wonderful figure of Jesus as a beautiful prophet, and that these truths will be more believable for modern people. And so they do this with a good intention and with a positive intention. But the church reacts against this, and therefore one of the great popes who then steps into the battle with modernism is Pope Pius X. Pope Pius X also suppresses modernism and challenges modernism. The theological reaction to modernism is that the church takes a renewed interest in the theology of and philosophy of Thomas Aquinas, and takes refuge in a kind of very academic and intellectual medieval sort of approach to theology and scriptural studies called scholasticism. And therefore, the seminaries and the theological colleges and the theologians which are promoted by the church during this time period are very intellectual, very abstract, and really locked into the Middle Ages. This is, of course, exactly the opposite of what the modernists were looking for and what the modernists really wanted to promote. Therefore, we can take a moment and look exactly at what the modernists were working towards. One of the most famous ones was the French theologian Loisy. He died in 1940, and he best expressed the modernist view. He argued that the critical historical sciences demanded that the Jesus of the ages, who was God and man, must be discarded and replaced by a Jesus who was only a prophet with a unique consciousness of being God's Messiah. And in other words, Jesus was not the second person of the Holy Trinity in human form. He was a prophet who understood himself in the highest possible way as being so fully human that he was divine. This is what the modernist thinks of Jesus. And furthermore, the sacraments, he thought, had to be replaced by a more sympathetic, symbolic understanding of the sacraments rather than the typical supernatural and traditional understanding. He saw a Jesus that was a figure of his own time period, and was a figure who was always moving with the times. And so Loisy said that the church also should always move with the times, and that its dogmas must be regarded not as fixed and unchangeable truths, but as attempts to summarize their experience at that particular place in time. I'm spending time over these tenets of modernism so that we can understand the struggle that we are still in today. First of all, the figure of Jesus. The modernists will say, you know, this talk about him being the Son of God or being God incarnate, that's symbolic language, which was appropriate for the first century. But now in the 20th and 21st century, we understand that language to mean that Jesus was such a wonderful human being that he shows us what the divine is like. You see how it works. They believe that the dogmas, as they are stated at particular time periods, are appropriate for those time periods, but we need to reinterpret them and we need to rephrase them. They would say about the sacraments, for instance, that the understanding that a miracle takes place on the altar under the hands of the priest, that was good for the Middle Ages when people believed that sort of thing, but now we understand that under the hands of the priest, something wonderful and symbolic takes place as we watch the priest do this action. And that draws us closer to Jesus. Along with this goes Loisy's understanding of something called vitality. And this, he says, is that the true forms of religion are developments, and they're caused by the circumstances of the time, and therefore there needs to be a continual growth and a continual evolution of these truths and a continual development of these truths as time goes on. Therefore, the truths themselves don't change, he would say, but our understanding of them changes and our expression of them changes from time to time. Well, there were other philosophers, Maurice Blondel, Lucien Labotonnière, also the Englishman Charles Tyrrell. Tyrrell was also a modernist who believed that the scholasticism had turned the church into a dry, abstract, intellectual system, and he wanted things to come alive and for the experience of each individual to be the vital driving force of the Catholic faith. He thought that the church officials were meant to be the spokesman of what all of the people in the church believed, and that the church is infallible simply as it continues to move through its struggles. Even when they can't see the way forward, even in that those struggles and those difficulties, the church's infallibility is still in place. Well, all of this is stamped on very heavily by Pope Pius X. Pius X is elected in 1903 at the death of Leo XIII, and in 1907 he issues the decree Lamentabili, and this is outlining a whole list of 65 errors from the writings of Loisy and Tyrell and the others. And the errors that were condemned were the errors that Jesus of history is inferior to the Christ of faith, and that Jesus' knowledge is limited, that he did not know of his messianic dignity, and it goes on and on straight through 65 different errors that the modernist had been propounding. Pius X, therefore, steps on modernism and roots it out completely in the early part of the 20th century. And he called for measures that really were almost like the medieval Inquisition. The vigilance committees were set up in every diocese to detect any sign of modernist doctrines. In addition, each diocese was to have a body of censors who were to watch over all literature connected with the church. These agencies observed strict secrecy. Seminarians were to be taught the scholastic system and Thomism, that is the philosophy of Thomas Aquinas. And all of them were required to take an oath against modernism. All priests, teachers, and seminarians were required to take an oath against modernism. In fact, in June 1908, on the fifth anniversary of Pius X's pontificate, a coin was minted in commemoration, showing him slaying a dragon, and it was slaying the modernist dragon. And it really was effective. Modernism was stamped out. And scholasticism was promoted as the official theology and philosophy of the Catholic Church. Well, modernism was stamped out, but of course, when something is stamped out like that, the intellectual vigor and the creativity of the academic world is also stamped out. And you might get conformity to the party line and get everyone to sign up and get the dissidents and get the others to be quiet. But of course, politics and church and living together shows us that this never really works, because it goes underground for a time, but it keeps coming back. So Pius X was this very strict pope. He was in himself, he was a simple parish priest, and he was also a lovely, gentle person. He is the one who said we should receive communion more frequently. He's the one who suggested that children should receive communion at the age of 7. And so the harshness of Pius X's clampdown on modernism was matched with a gentle soul and a saintly soul. Indeed, he has been canonized, Pope St. Pius X. And like Pius IX in the 19th century, he was a pope of great gentleness and charm, a pope that was very lovable and loved, but at the same time, a great hammer of heretics, one who really did suppress and push down modernism to the best of his ability. Well, Pius X dies in 1914, and one of the most unusual popes of the 20th century is elected in his place, Pope Benedict XV. And he's elected in 1914, right at the dawn of the First World War. And it's appropriate, I suppose, to mention that at this time, this was, of course, the time of the visions at Fatima, which predicted such terrible prophecies about the events in the 20th century. We have to also remember the legend that the Pope during this time period, and I think it was Pope Pius X, had a vision of the devil taking, being given power over the world for 100 years to do his very worst. And many people think that that was from perhaps began in 1917 at the end of the First World War, or 1914 with the visions of with the visions of Fatima, and at 1917 rather, in the visions of Fatima, and the events therefore the 20 that go on now into the 20th century are most terrible. And what a lot of commentators and historians fail to do is to see how the terrible events of the 20th century, the First and Second World Wars, also are linked in with the problems of the last 500 years in the area of theology and philosophy. Because, of course, if you do go along with modernism, along with that goes relativism, and therefore the underlying lack of faith and the underlying lack of authority and the underlying lack of the Christian faith in Europe produces these great tensions which then erupt in the two world wars. Well, Benedict XV was a very frail and very physically slight pope, but also a very strong character. He tried very hard to call the nations away from war, and he condemned the First World War completely. He dies in 1922, and is succeeded by Pius XI. Pius XI takes the church through the period between the two wars in 1922 from 1922 to 1939, and he at first is establishing concordats with the different rising dictatorships in Europe, in Spain, in Italy, and in Germany. And he sees them as forces for good when they're first rising, and forces of national unity. And he makes a concordat, for instance, with Mussolini. And it's Mussolini who gives the Pope a large grant of money and finally gives him the Vatican City State, as we understand it today. If you go to Rome and you approach St. Peter's up the great broad avenue that leads from the Tiber up to the Basilica of St. Peter's, that great avenue was built by Mussolini in honor of the Concordat, which was established with Pope Pius XI, and established the Vatican, therefore, is in the center of Rome as we know it today in the modern world. However, as we know, things began to get worse under both Mussolini and Hitler. And Pius XI, towards the end of his pontificate, as he saw that things for the church and for the Europe were continuing to descend into what would probably be another war, he stands up to Hitler. He condemns the racism, he condemns the tyranny, and he condemns what he could see was going on and was about to go on in Europe in the terrible events of World War II. His Secretary of State is then elected as Pope Pius XII. Pope Pius XII is this regal, aristocratic figure, this slender, tall aristocrat who ascends to the throne of Peter after Pius XI. And Pius XII takes the church through World War II and also into the rise of communism and the rapid technological changes of the 1940s and 1950s, and steers the church as best as he can through the terrors of the Second World War. All of these events are fascinating, and the books about the relationship of the popes to the First World War and the Second World War are worth their own study and spending some more time in digging into those, because they're controversial, they're dramatic, they're full of intrigue. And we know Pius XII, for instance, was famous for saving as many Jews from the Nazis as he possibly could, and using his powers while still remaining neutral to counter the evil that was going on in Europe during the Second World War. We're going to spend more time next time picking up the papacy from there. You will know that after Pius XII is John the 23rd, and then Paul the 6th, and then John Paul the 1st, John Paul the 2nd, and then into the 21st century with Benedict the 16th and now Pope Francis. And we're going to spend time in the next episode looking at the huge changes that come about in the Second Vatican Council. Essentially, the Second World War ends and Pius XII is Pope for another 10 years, roughly, until John the 23rd is elected. And then John the 23rd, who was an elderly sort of caretaker Pope, surprises everybody by calling the Second Vatican Council. I would like to spend just a few moments now also reminding you about the great advances that the Church has made around the world during this 19th and 20th centuries. The spiritual revival really begins in the 19th century under Pope Gregory the 16th, who was Pope from 1831 to 1846. You might remember I mentioned him, that he was one of the first to step down on liberalism before Pius the Ninth was elected. But he also, during that time, helped to rejuvenate the old religious orders, the Jesuits, the Franciscans, and the Dominicans, and also some new religious orders, the White Fathers, the Schutt Fathers from Germany, and the Mill Hill Fathers from England. And these religious went out to, as colonialism was expanding, went out to expand the church. One of the areas that they went was India and Japan and China, out into the Far East. The church made substantial gains in India all during this time period in the 19th and 20th century. China was more difficult. It began making great strides in China as well and expanding in China, but the Chinese Revolution, of course, after the Second World War, put great strains on the church in China, and ones which we're experiencing even now as the Vatican tries to establish some kind of agreement with China. Basically, China created a state church for all Christians, and the Catholic Church went underground, the church that was loyal to the Pope. In Japan, there was a strong Christian movement that took place. And the church continued to grow, and despite a great sort of persecution that took place in China after the first missionary efforts in the 16th and 17th century. In Japan, also, the history of missions was amazing. It was St. Francis Xavier in 1549 who first made progress there. But then in 1638 was a terrible extermination of Christians. Some 35,000 were massacred as the Japanese clamped down on the Japanese authorities clamped down on this foreign religion. Some of the victims were subjected to terrible torture, being hung upside down in a pit and being bled slowly to death. And the church, therefore, from the mid-1600s onward in Japan, has been virtually stamped out. When the United States came into Japan and opened up a new treaty in the middle of the 1850s, so for about 200 years, Christianity had been stamped out. And then Japan opened up to Christianity again. And as the missionaries went in there in the mid-1800s, they found amazingly that there were little groups of Christians who had managed to hold on to the essentials of the Christian faith without any contact with the outside world. This little underground church in Japan had been kept alive, and laymen would preach and teach and baptize and administer consolation to the dying. And when the missionaries came back in the mid-1800s, the mid-19th century, they found amazingly that these Christians had survived for 200 years keeping the faith alive in an underground church. Well, progress continued also under Pius XI in The early 20th century, he established dioceses across Japan, and although it's still minority religion, Catholicism has taken root in Japan, also in Korea, in the Philippines, and Indonesia, all across the south, in Pakistan, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Ceylon, Malaysia, Burma, Thailand. In all these countries, the Catholicism began to spread during the 19th and 20th century. And then there is, of course, the incredible story of Africa. The Christian missionary action in Africa continued during the period of colonization and continued to expand all through the 19th and 20th century. And the missionaries found it that the native peoples of Africa, for the most part, were very enthusiastic to receive the faith. In Uganda, also in Kenya, both Protestant and Catholic missionaries made great headway. In Congo, Rwanda, Burundi, Kenya, Malawi, Tanzania, all across Africa, the church grew and continues to grow. Now, the foundations for the church around the world, therefore, really took off in the 19th and in the 20th centuries, despite the great tragedies and problems that the church was struggling with. And again, it goes back to the struggle between modernism and the historic Catholic faith, between liberalism and the historic Catholic faith. It's no mistake that when the authentic Catholic faith was being stressed and modernism and liberalism were being suppressed, that this is the same time of missionary effort. Because, of course, if you follow modernism and Christianity is just the religion of yet another prophet and a religion which adapts to whatever age it's in and adapts its doctrines to whatever culture it's in, then you can't really engage in any missionary activity because there's nothing to evangelize people to. It was during the time that the church was suppressing liberalism and modernism that also the great missionary efforts which have expanded the church have taken place. It's important to realize that this is all happening at the same time that Europe is caught up in the First and Second World Wars, the church is in the meantime, God is expanding his church all over the world. In the next episode, we will deal with the Second Vatican Council, but we'll also deal with, as we move forward, looking to the Church of the future and seeing how the missionary efforts that took place in the 19th and 20th centuries actually bore rich fruit. The other area which we have to think about briefly is the church in North America, our own American church. Again, this is a topic of great interest, which could take up an entire episode itself or more. The growth of the Catholic Church in America, going back to the 17th and 18th centuries, was very slow to start with because, of course, the founding fathers were mostly Protestant. If you remember your history about the 13 colonies, it was only Maryland which was set apart as a colony for Catholics. And even then, they were persecuted. And at one point, the religious liberty for Catholics in Maryland was taken away as well. Nevertheless, a few dioceses are started. One of them is Charleston, these are a few dioceses get started around the end of the 1700s and then into the 1800s as the waves of immigration then really begin in America. And it's during the 19th century that we see the great waves of Catholic immigrants from Poland, from Italy, from Ireland, from Central Europe, from Spain and Portugal, and all these European countries flooding into the United States. And with them, they bring their Catholic religion. And therefore, in the 19th century, the Catholic religion is spreading amazingly in the United States. Churches, schools, colleges, universities are being funded and springing up at an amazing rate. And as the westward expansion goes on, so Catholicism is taken out to the Native Americans and out to the coast. And the progress from the East Coast of America meets the missionary efforts that had already been made by the Spanish, who had come up from Mexico into the West Coast and come up out from Florida, even as far as Georgia and South Carolina. So the missionary efforts are sweeping across the United States in the 19th century. And then in the by the 20th century, the American church is strong. The American church is powerful. The American church is a great player in the world development of world Catholicism. It's wealthy and it's more and more dominant in the world scene. This has to be enough to take us up to the beginning of the 1960s. And we're going to leave the story there for this episode because Pope Pius XII dies in 1958 and John the 23rd is elected. And we're going to pick up the story with John the 23rd and take time to talk about the Second Vatican Council, because at the Second Vatican Council, once again, the church is struggling with the modern world. If you remember the history that we've gone through in this episode, in the 19th century, you can think of Pope Pius IX, Pio Nono, basically suppresses liberalism, and the church experiences a great move forward as there's a return to conservative historic Catholicism. In the 20th century, the movement to modernize the church springs back, and it's Pius X with his suppression of modernism, which crushes the dragon down once again. But of course, by the 1960s, the modern world had advanced even more rapidly with new technologies and with new understandings and new science and new theology and new philosophies, which were going to continue to challenge the world. And it's Pius, it's John the 23rd who succeeds Pius the 12th in 1958, who then is going to open up the Second Vatican Council, where he really calls the fathers of the church to come together to deal with the modern world and how is Catholicism going to cope with the modern world. And it is this crisis at the beginning of the 1960s, which is going to take us right through the last 40 years of the 20th century and now into the first 20 years of the 21st century, where we are now. And I hope that you, as we move into the next episode and discuss these things in more detail, that this whole series you will have seen has come to a great climax. Just to remind you of the series that we've been through, we can break the history of the Catholic Church down into these 500-year segments. The first 500 years is the Roman period, the time when the Church is under persecution, and then in the early 300s becomes the Church of the Roman Empire and expands across the known world of the Roman Empire. And then at the turning point of around 500, with the rise of monasticism and Saint Benedict, we see the church going into the Dark Ages, a dark time when the church existed in small communities, and the papacy and the church in Rome was locked in political struggles and in immorality and in corruption. And for 500 years, it is really struggling in those dark ages, but all the time the light is being kept burning brightly within the monastic movement, which is slowly spreading at a grassroots level all across Europe, from the east in Ireland, and then also from from the west in Ireland, and also from the east from Saint Benedict and the Benedictines. And then the next 500 milestone is 1,000. The year 1000, the first millennium, when the break with Eastern Orthodoxy takes place, but also the church moves into the Middle Ages. The Middle Ages being this flowering of Christendom, when the entire, all of Europe eventually is evangelized, and all of Europe is part of the established church, part of the Catholic Church, and the loyalty to the Catholic Church as an overarching force for civilization within the Middle Ages, this time of Christendom, this 500 years between 1000 and 1500. And then at 1500, the momentous 16th century with all of the amazing things which happened in the church with Michelangelo and Donatello and the Renaissance, but also and Shakespeare, but also Henry VIII and Luther and the Reformation, and the age, the church moves into an age of revolution and into an age of upheaval. And those next 500 years, from 1500 to our present age, are the age of revolution, the age of upset and turmoil, in which the church survives, but does so as a bark sailing from age to age on a very stormy sea. Well, we're going to pick it up for our final episode next time, talking about the Second Vatican Council, and then also looking forward to the future. Where is the church today, and what does the next 500 years look like in this amazing history of triumphs and tragedies in the Catholic Church? I'm Dwight Longenecker, and I thank you for listening so far. I'd like to remind you that there are some other podcasts on my blog. Stories of the Unexpected is a podcast in which I tell very short stories of the supernatural, the marvelous, the miraculous that have happened to me, and reflect on them a little bit. That episode, that series, is behind the paywall on my blog, so that's open for donor subscribers. I've enjoyed these podcasts, and I'm going to be doing some more as we move forward. Another history podcast is coming up, which is going to be called Characters of the Reformation. I will be basically reading an abridged version of Hilaire Belloc's famous book, Characters of the Reformation, and then making my own comments on it so we can learn more about the amazing things which took place during the 16th century. So that'll continue to be a free podcast, which I will be posting as part of my history series on the Catholic Church. Characters of the Reformation is coming up after this series, and I'm also going to be doing some fiction podcasts called True Fairy Tales, which will be on my blog, and I'll simply be telling some stories which should be entertaining for you and for your children and grandchildren. I have some other ideas for podcasts as well, but I encourage you to join the blog if you can. If you can be a donor subscriber and help with the production costs and with the hosting and maintenance costs of the blog, then I would appreciate that. If the Lord has blessed you and you can afford to do that, just go to the page that says subscribe and sign up there and help to promote this and get this message out to more and more people. This has been Triumphs and Tragedies. I'm Father Dwight Longenecker. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media. Find more about us at breadboxmedia.com.